Hey folks, Micah here. We're about to get started, but before we do, I just want to remind you that you can always get show notes for this and every other episode at ChristianTransHumanistPodcast.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for email updates so we can let you know when new shows are released, when new things happen in the Christian transhumanist community, and most importantly, so that we can connect you with other people just like you exploring questions just like this. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy the show. Well, I'm Micah Redding, and I'm here with Dr. Calvin Mercer, who's the professor of religious studies at East Carolina University, the founder of the American Academy of Religion's Transhumanism and Religion Group, and the author of 7 books, including Religion and Transhumanism, The Unknown Future of Human Enhancement, Transhumanism and the Body, The World Religions Speak, and Religion and the Implications of Radical Life Extension. So thank you, Dr. Mercer, for joining me today.
Well, I'm very pleased to join you, yes.
Well, so let's just start at the beginning. For someone who's new to transhumanism, the idea of that, how would you define it? How would you explain what that is?
This is not so much my definition. I'm drawing on others, but it is often thought of as an intellectual movement, and even you could say a cultural movement, but it's certainly very connected to science and technology. So it's an intellectual and cultural movement using science and technology to radically enhance human beings. And I think to underscore radical there, living, you know, for example, physical enhancement, living 120, we may reach that with traditional medical science, but we're talking about eliminating aging in the human species. So that's what we mean by radical. And as this has unfolded, there are really several categories of enhancement. There's the physical, for example, healthy longevity, healthy extreme longevity. There's cognitive enhancement. There's, we could say, affective or emotional enhancement. And there is, I guess one of the newest debates is around moral enhancement. And in fact, there are those who say that our physical and cognitive enhancement technologies are going to get way ahead of our ability to manage them effectively. And so we need to enhance ourselves morally in order to make sure we properly manage the other enhancements. And then there's actually, my friend Ron Cole Turner has actually suggested that we can talk about spiritual enhancement as well. But those are the different categories. I guess the physical enhancement and radical life extension was the first major foray into this.
Yeah. So let's talk about that a little bit. So you're talking about, you know, radically extending human lifespan. So radical life extension. Well, first of all, what would be involved in that? And what are some common kind of misconceptions about what is actually being discussed there?
Well, let's get a common misconception out of the way first. When many people in our society think of living for long periods of time, they think of being hooked up to, you know, to IV tubes in a nursing home, barely hanging on. And that is not at all what the transhumanist and human enhancement advocates are after. I mean, they're after healthy longevity and even youthful longevity. So we're not talking about feebleness and just hanging on for decades or even centuries. We're talking about using various technologies for healthy human life extension. And you asked the methods, the technologies, several. One, it would be genetic engineering. This is a very layman's terms, and I'm not, my background is not hard science. So in layman's terms, the scientists are working to basically identify those genes responsible for aging and switch them off. And I'll mention here one of the most getting a lot of attention right now is the CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R, mm-hmm. technology that is many would say is going to be very, very promising. Dr. Church at Harvard Medical School, Dr. George Church, has this remarkable statement that he thinks that perhaps the aging process can be reversed in 5 or 6 years, and he made that statement in 2015, late 2015. So who knows where that's going to go, but it's just one of many genetic engineering technologies. Tissue and organ replacement, tissue generation. I drive an old Jeep, and when the transmission goes bad, I replace it and still consider it my Jeep. Theoretically, over time, I could replace, you know, every part of the Jeep. So I'm hinting here at many of the philosophical and theological issues, regarding personal identity and that sort of thing that are involved in some of these technologies. But certainly tissue regeneration is advancing.
That's kind of I think I heard about a car that's, still going multiple millions of miles driven, and, every part on it has been replaced at some point, right? So that's kind of what you're talking about, right? Like, you could just kind of keep replacing parts and never have to get rid of the car.
Right. I'm in Eastern North Carolina, and right down the street, so to speak, not literally down the street, but, several hours away, is the Wake Forest North Carolina Institute for Regenerative Medicine, world-renowned. They've grown bladders, blood vessels, windpipes, vaginas, and they're working. So this whole field of regenerative medicine is very promising with regard to longevity. Mm-hmm. So genetic engineering, tissue and organ replacement. My someone that I've worked with who's very well known is Aubrey de Grey, who has a laser focus on terminating aging in the human species. He has a whole different program. It's more of a biological kind of cleaning up the biological waste or whatever or damage that occurs in our natural biological processes. So he's got a whole different approach to this that's beyond genetic engineering and tissue regeneration. Merging of computer technology and human biology. One of the things that I work on that you may have that may be of interest to your audience is called whole brain emulation or mind uploading. And this too, that if you, and this sounds, it sounds a fringe, but they're very serious people working to scan and upload, if you will, the memory and personality, which some would say that's who we are, that's what constitutes who we are, the information in our brain into some more reliable platform, if you will. And once you do that, then you've eliminated aging, because what it is that ages is our body. And if you move that into an electronic format, well, then that's another way to solve aging. So there's a lot of, there's several paths forward to radical life extension, and there are very serious people working on all of this. All of this was the stuff of science fiction just a few decades ago, but it is, I promise you, it is not anymore only the stuff of science fiction.
Yeah, well, a couple of things you mentioned, on the whole brain emulation path, I'm not sure whether you're familiar with this, but the Brian Johnson, the founder of Braintree, recently funded the Kernel Project with Craig Venter from the Human Genome Project. to do complete basically brain genome, to be able to interface directly with the brain and scan it and so forth. So, and he put I believe $100 million into this project. So these things are becoming very well funded, these kinds of projects. And you mentioned, of course, Aubrey de Grey, who's working on, you know, biological life extension. Calico Labs at Google is also doing this. So yeah, you're absolutely right. This is something that's happening, increasingly moving out of science fiction into science projects.
Yeah, and you're exactly right, Micah, that about the money flow. I think that is important enough to underscore that there are several pieces to this. But basically, when the billionaire class sniffs the possibility that their children could be smarter, play the violin better, and that they and their elderly parents could live, you know, healthy for decades, if not centuries, indefinitely. Basically, I mean, the money I think is going to flow here, and it's already starting to flow. One very significant moment, I think, is when a man by the name of Ray Kurzweil, who is, if there's one name that is the leading, I guess, futurist, the leading, advocate for radical human enhancement, it'd be Ray Kurzweil. He's an inventor. He's a brilliant. He's a genius. And I think it was in 2012 that Google, now a subsidiary of Alphabet, Incorporated, hired him as their something like their director of engineering. So here you have the leading transhumanist visionary sitting on top of, you know, I think we would all agree, not literally unlimited, but plenty of cash. And yeah, so the business world is getting into this. I mean, and, Bill Gates has been briefed, Peter Thiel of the PayPal, there's some Russian billionaires. So, you know, we know that the billionaire class is onto this, and, you know, that is going to, I think, have an impact. Of course, transhumanists would like for governments to get, you know, more engaged too. I know governments are, at least I know our government knows what's going on. Some of this comes out of the Pentagon, but you know how much funding, that's a political process.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. So maybe that's a good place to jump into some of the ethical issues. I want to come back to some of the other things. So, because we're talking here about this kind of life extension, and then there's the other stuff, cognitive enhancement, emotional enhancement, moral enhancement, and even spiritual enhancement. But in terms of some of the ethical and societal dilemmas that come from that, just what we've talked about so far, what are the big things you've mentioned? Like, this is, you know, billionaires are going to jump on board. What does that mean about where this is going?
Well, one way to frame this is that I've said that in some of my lectures and writings that I think that extreme human enhancement developments are going to make for strange bedfellows. In the past, we've been able to sort of identify, you know, the right wing and the right and the left, you know, liberal conservative on judicial matters and political matters, economic matters. I mean, you know, the lines they're not crystal clear, but you know, we generally know what we're talking about when we say left and right in various domains. But I think that human enhancement is going to shake this up. I think you're going to have, for example, conservative Christians who are going to come down on the side of pro-radical enhancement and some on the side of anti. And so you're going to have, for example, liberal Christians who who side with conservative Christians fighting against radical human enhancement developments, and that may do it for different reasons. The conservative, just to tease this particular line out, the conservative Christians may oppose radical human enhancement because it is, you know, because of a maybe a default concern against about science, and you know, a more, you know, more of a traditional view that regards science as suspect, and enhancement is science-based and technology-based. But why would the liberal Christian oppose this? I mean, we are helping people, you know, overcome illness and disease and be happier, and you know, they embrace science. Well, many of the liberal Christian thinkers are very, very concerned about what's called distributive justice, that these technologies are going to be you know, afforded by and accessed by the rich and the powerful, and so they're concerned about justice issues. So I'm just teasing out one little line here, but those are the kinds of ways things are going to be shaken up, I think. You know, there's responses to all of this. I mean, you say, well, you know, this is only going to be for the rich and powerful. I mean, again, there's responses to all of this. On that particular one, technology, we know, generally comes down over time. You know, it's very expensive at first, and then it becomes less expensive. And Aubrey de Grey has told me, I don't know if he's actually put this in writing or not, but that he thinks that with regard to radical life extension, you know, if for example we begin to really unlock that key, that unlock that riddle, let's say we figure out how to quadruple the lifespan of a mouse. Well, because of the transferability of research from a mouse to human beings, once it hits the front pages of the newspaper that we can quadruple the lifespan of a mouse, then everybody knows this, you know, we're on the road to doing that for human beings. But Aubrey says it'll be 10 years. Even if we've got plenty of funding, it's going to take at least 10 years to transfer that research. And his argument is that once this technology is out there, that because of our maybe very primitive but very strong sort of quest for longevity, for survival, it's a basic instinct that we have as human beings, that the rich and powerful are simply not going to be able to hold this in. I mean, the masses are going to demand access to this. This is his argument. And, you know, you can come back against that. I mean, certainly education has not been made available to everybody all over the world. But those are, you know, those are some of the back and forth discussions around the distribution of these, the fair and just distribution of these technologies once we develop them.
Yeah. So if there are these kind of strange bedfellows of the liberal and the conservative religious voices on one side, what's on the other side? What other strange bedfellows might there be in this equation?
Well, I think there are liberals and conservatives who, on the other side, will embrace these technologies. And you know, we could talk about why conservatives might and why liberals might. You know, conservatives, although they're suspect of science many times, and because science is associated with, you know, the evil world in an extreme right-wing view, still, when their children get sick, they take them to the doctor, and you know, when their spouse has a heart attack, they take them to the doctor and partake of medical science, right? Because every human being, there are exceptions, of course, psychological aberrations, but generally speaking, all human beings have an instinct for survival. And my view is, because I have training in psychology, I also have clinical psych training and work 10 years part-time in that field, and so I use psychology to understand religious behavior sometimes. And I think even the most conservative Christian theology, underneath that is an instinct for survival. You could almost say it an anxiety, a dread before the threat of non-being, if you want to say it that way. And so that trumps, if I could use that word, trumps the theology. In other words, you can take theology, I don't care how conservative it is, and you can, I hate to say twist it, but you can manipulate it to justify or reflect, you know, lots of different positions. And one of the things that I do is my training, or a lot of my training, is in biblical studies. And so when I talk about whole brain emulation or mind uploading, you know, I'm exploring ways in which that can be understood in the context of the Christian doctrine of resurrection. I think that conservatives, because of their survival instinct, are going to many of them are eventually going to embrace radical enhancement. And liberals, of course, they're open already. Their default mode is to be open to science and technology. And as long as it's fairly distributed and accessible to everyone, and it is promoting health and well-being, then I see no reason why they would not eventually embrace it as well. These are general statements. So there's going to be people on both sides of these issues.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I believe you've done work with Steve Fuller, and I think kind of terminology that he uses is upwing versus downwing, to reflect this kind of an other axis, basically, that splits through the kind of traditional liberal and conservative divide and makes these, you know, kind of makes these strange pairings. We have a new basis for action, is whether we're in favor of moving forward into these kinds of things or against it. If we think politics is interesting now, just wait, huh?
It is going to be very, very, very interesting, I think, how this unfolds. Just one footnote, since you mentioned Steve Fuller. Steve Fuller and I are co-editors of a new series, and just get the name of the series. I mean, that tells a lot, doesn't it? Palgrave Studies in the Future of Humanity and Its Successors. Palgrave Study in the Future of Humanity and Its Successors. We are on about book four or five in that series now. The name of the series actually opens up another whole area, which we've been talking about human enhancement, but there are very real questions about the future of humanity, and that what we're going to see in all of this is that humanity is going to go the way of dinosaurs, and we're going to move into a post-human, world, and this opens up, the whole question of super intelligence and robotics and all of that. So it's not at all clear that we're going to always be talking about human enhancement.
You've opened a whole door there. So that's another, you know, the term post-human, the prospect that we're basically on our way to becoming post-human, which almost seems like a contradiction in terms, right? How do humans stop being humans? What does that you know, I think these terms get thrown around a lot. How would you define post-human? What makes someone post-human in that sense?
Well, I don't know that rather than framing it, what will make me post-human or make a particular human being post-human, it's more that over time we are going to life, if you want to say it that, life on this planet is going to evolve into a post-human, species. Life. We're going to evolve new forms of life, and super intelligence may very well be a critical part of that. So super intelligence is machine intelligence that surpasses general human intelligence. Now, we've got computers now that can beat us at chess and a host of other games and can do simple translations. So computers are better at human beings right now in certain very selected areas, memory, for example. They have more memory. But we have not yet got a computer that has general human intelligence that, that can recognize a face when it comes in the door. So, but they're working on this. I mean, I think there was a time when the computer experts, there was a debate about whether we were going to be able to have a machine that achieves general human intelligence. I think now the experts are voting that, yes, we are going to achieve that. It's a question of when. And once a machine achieves general human intelligence, then it's just a question of time, the experts think, before it moves beyond general human intelligence into what we call super intelligence. And that raises all kinds of questions about personhood? Is there consciousness? And also there are people who are very worried that when we achieve superintelligence, that if we're not careful to what we call value load that superintelligence, put values in there, that the superintelligence could do us in. I mean, if you've got a superintelligence and its mission statement gets sort of goes awry and it thinks its mission is to build paperclips, well, think about it. You got a machine that's 20 times more intelligent than the average human being. You hook it up to robotics so it can actually manipulate the world. You hook it up to the internet so it has unlimited information, and it says my goal is to make paperclips. Well, it might turn this glass of water here into paperclips. It might turn my phone into paperclips. It might turn you and me into paperclips. And so there are people worried about this, that when we get to this super intelligence, that we're going to have real problems at controlling it, and so we want to value load it. I work on the theological side of this, and just to throw this in one forthcoming publication I have, I've called for the development of artificial intelligence theology. That's maybe not a real great term, but it's the only one I came up with. But we need to think theologically about how to understand superintelligence, when and if it arrives. How do we understand that? Does that superintelligence have the capability to relate to God, for example? What happens, when that occurs? And, we're really kind of starting, well, we're not totally starting from scratch. I suggest that one area that we might draw upon is, it's not very developed, not very mature, but there has been some thought by theologians in the past about, what it would mean if we discover life in outer space, right?
Yeah.
Non-human intelligent life, sentient life in outer space. That's a theoretical possibility. Well, how do we understand that? I mean, even in the traditional notions of, God was incarnated in Jesus Christ in the Christian framework, in a salvific way for human beings. I mean, the Bible was written by human beings for human beings. So what does it mean if you discover life, intelligent life, you know, on another planet? So that might be a place to start as we attempt to understand how to religiously and theologically understand superintelligence. Either that or the religions will just simply, you know, become irrelevant. And so, you know, there's that whole question about superintelligence. It's a fascinating one to me.
Yeah, and on that point, the Pope recently, I think, offered to baptize Martians if they showed up, right? So there has been, even if that's kind of a little tongue-in-cheek, there has been a lot of thought from within, maybe not a lot, but there has been thought within these religious traditions of how one would deal with such a thing. So that does present us some kind of interesting parallels. But it's interesting to me that you're pointing out if we don't address these, then it simply becomes religion becomes irrelevant. If it can't address these new incredibly disruptive changes, right, then it will simply no longer apply to the world we live in.
Right. Yeah, my view of religion is that it's nimble. That's not a technical word, but just a word that comes to my mind. And if you look at the development of religion through the centuries, it is nimble. It is flexible, and it does evolve. Buddhism came out of Hinduism. Christianity came out of Judaism, and Christianity has evolved into different branches. And so I think religion is nimble, and I believe that religion is valuable. I think it offers something that doesn't, that science is not prepared to offer, and it offers it has value, but if it gets hardened and it doesn't think about these technological developments, then it's going to become irrelevant. And I think that it can be nimble, and I think it can be, you can do constructive theology in a way that maintains core values and does not give up on the tradition, but also is relevant and valuable in helping to guide, for example, these technological developments in ways that are useful and fruitful.
There are several different things that you were kind of bringing out a little bit about, you know, like essentially what I'm hearing is with super intelligent AI, do they have a creation story? Is it the same as our creation story? Is it a different, you know, are there, is it a different thing? Do we think of them as being made in the image of God? Do we, you know, what categories do we apply to those beings? And I'd say most people don't have good answers to that kind of question.
That's right. This is new territory. And, you know, I have some of my more skeptical colleagues who say, you know, why are you working on this? I mean, we're all going to be dead and gone. I mean, this is going to be hundreds of years. Well, first of all, I'm not sure it's going to be hundreds of years. But even if it is 100 years away, some of this stuff, I mean, it takes time to assimilate this and to think it through. In the scope of history, 100 years is not that long. But some of these developments are experts, suggest that we may be looking at them this century.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier that one of the things that you explore is the theological implications of mind uploading, or how that would work within a context of talking about, you know, the biblical ideas of resurrection and so forth. So what are some of the ways that you've explored that?
Well, one of the issues that has appropriately, I think, risen to the fore in this discussion is the role of the role of physicality, the role of body, because transhumanists are sometimes accused of by Christian thinkers of being dualist, of being of adhering to a sort of a Gnostic or Neoplatonic view that the soul is somehow trapped inside the body. Soul, in this case, for transhumanists would be, you know, mind or information in our brain, and that transhumanists don't really appreciate and indeed denigrate the body. Now, there's a little bit of truth to that in this sense, that transhumanists do basically say, and there's a wonderful letter by Max Moore, a letter to Mother Nature, that basically says, we appreciate, you know, you brought us this far, we appreciate that, you've done the best you can, but now we'll take it from here. Thanks. We don't anymore need, you know, diseased, aging, painful, hurtful bodies. We'll take it from here. We appreciate how far you've got us, but thanks.
Right.
And we'll take it here with technology. Now, the little bit of, you know, like denigration of the body there, I guess you could say, I'm probably in the minority among Christian theologians on this point, but I have been arguing that I agree that the body is important, that I think there are reasons to think that who we are cannot be limited simply to the information in our brain, that the physicality is important. It's how we interact with the environment. I think there's feedback from the body to the brain and to the information in the brain and so on. But I don't think that means that something like mind uploading is non-Christian or can't be incorporated. Resurrection is resurrection of the body. So I agree that the body is important. Physicality is important. But what will happen, one scenario with mind uploading is that once we are able to fully scan the information in the brain and upload it to a digital platform, then you can also give it a body. I mean, tissue regeneration, robotics can give it that physicality. And so I don't think we necessarily reject out of hand mind uploading simply because it leaves the body behind. I mean, for Pete's sake, you know, Jesus' body could move through doors and appear on the road to Emmaus. And there was a connection between his pre-death body and his resurrected body because, you know, he told doubting Thomas, you know, put your hands in the nail in the holes in my hand. So there's this continuity, there's a connection, but it is a transformed body. I mean, Paul says it's glorious and imperishable and strong. And so the Christian doctrine of resurrection is quite different from the notion of resuscitation of a dead body. Jesus raised Lazarus and resuscitated his body, but Christian eschatological resurrection is not resuscitation of a dead body. It is transformative new being. And so I don't know, it seems to me when you upload your, if you get to the point where you upload your information in your brain into a computer and are able to have flesh grow around it and so on, why could that not at least be a candidate for a form of resurrection? And again, I don't know the answers here, and maybe there are no right or wrong answers when you're trying to apply theology, but I'm open to that. I think those conversations are important and interesting.
Yeah, that actually makes me think about, you know, this terminology around mind uploading. There's been pushback on that where people are saying, well, that's not actually an accurate way to describe what we're talking about. What we're talking about is substrate independent minds, meaning that we want to be able to move our mind from this one particular carbon-based instantiation into another kind of instantiation, both of which are embodied. And so the uploading terminology sometimes leaves the impression that we're actually moving out of the physical world. But as you've pointed out, that's not actually what's being described. It's talking about a transformation. And that's interesting to me that kind of dynamic in Christian theology that you're pointing out, which is that there is a continuity but a radical transformation at the same time. Then somehow those two things are held in tension, where resurrection of the body is important in that we remain embodied. There's a continuity aspect to it, but there is this also radical discontinuity at the same time. And
right.
That's a lot of things to try to explore and balance.
Right. Now, another issue, this is a very complicated philosophical issue, and I'll just throw it out, but it's the issue of the continuation of personal identity. Because if we can figure out how to scan and upload the information in my brain into a new digital format platform, well, if we can do it once, we could probably do it twice, right? And that means there's two out there rather than one. And so the question is, what is the continuation of personal identity in that situation? When I put a sheet of paper in the Xerox machine and there comes out a copy, that copy is not the same as the original. Right. There's a copy and then there's the original. So the whole question of personal identity is a philosophical conversation that has a long history. And I'm not a trained philosopher, but I sort of found myself, plunged into that conversation too. And then there's the issue of, if we do the mind uploading, is it going to be destructive of the original mind? And, if it's not, then you got Calvin, and then you got, copy number one out there and copy number two. So it raises not only philosophical questions about personal identity, it raises theological questions. I mean, look, I think the doctrine of resurrection can handle, a mind upload. But I have to admit, you got to really stretch it, and it makes you really start thinking hard when you start thinking about two uploads or a half dozen.
Well, that stretches everything, right? That stretches our theology, our concept of self. I don't know
the legal question. Yeah, the legal question.
Yeah, everything. Have you found any kind of trails into that? Any kind of first steps to be able to kind of split apart that problem or that dilemma, or get an easier way to grapple with it?
Well, I'm working on it, but I mean, I'm not sure if this pans out or not, but identical twins, that may help here in terms, like if you make two copies, then, they're the same for a split second, right? And then it's like identical twins. They go their own way. They interact in the environment in different ways. They may look alike. They may be very similar. They may, have similar tendencies and psychological predispositions. But one lives in Colorado and one lives in Australia. They develop different lives and marry different people. So, if we make a half dozen copies of Micah, then maybe they all look at each other at the, at one brief instant, but then they go their own ways. And so, this gets into, creation. What is entailed in the creation of a human being? How does that happen? And, what's the Christian understanding of that? So it's a wild and woolly terrain that we're moving into.
Yeah, definitely. That kind of brings up, things that come up in the pro-life and pro-choice debates, And I'm not well versed on the science of this, but in identical twins, as you're saying, they start out as a single being and then split, right? So I think the most absolute pro-life position would say that they were, by the same definition used elsewhere, one being, and then they become two beings.
Right.
So it's already in our, it's already there in the things that we deal with now. But definitely the ability to duplicate ourselves in any kind of way is going to make that problem apparent and kind of front and center in a way it's never been before.
Yeah, so it's a complication, but I don't know that it's an insurmountable one. God loves both identical twins, right?
Yeah.
So what's the big deal? In one sense, yeah. I mean, it is a big deal, but I don't know we even need to stop in our tracks and say, the Christian tradition cannot handle this.
Right. Well, also, what I'm hearing too is that what we might think of as the kind of conservative or traditional reaction, which would be to push back against any of that, actually doesn't give us an answer. It just delays being able to ask the question, because those things really aren't answered in our theology. Like we don't really know right now why we, what would happen if we duplicate ourselves. We just don't have to deal with that issue.
Right.
So it's not an answer not to address the question or not to consider the possibility.
Correct. And there was when I started working on all this stuff about a dozen years ago, there were real questions. There still are some to some degree, but there were questions about whether, some of these developments are going to occur or not. For example, whether we're going to develop superintelligence, where that's possible or not, where mm-hmm. it's possible to develop a machine that's more intelligent than the creator of the machine, human being.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the dozen years I've been working on this, I think that the conversation has shifted, the thinking has shifted. It's not a question anymore of whether some of these things are going to happen. I think there are. And so, the sooner we get about, doing the social and political and economic and theological work around it, the better.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I think that's a great conversation to have, and I'm glad you've been doing so much to do it, to advance that. I want to ask you about, you mentioned the psychology of fundamentalism. I know you've worked a lot with that. What are your takeaways in terms of how to think about fundamentalism maybe in a better way? Or what if we're trying to address fundamentalist concerns and so forth, how do we need to approach that? And then also, if you are a fundamentalist, what are some things to know about, I guess, your own psychology? And I was raised fundamentalist. I consider myself fundamentalist in some respects. This is something that's very interesting to me. What would you say, I should be aware of in my own psychology or should be working with in that respect?
Now, are you asking this apart from transhumanism or as a part of or in relationship to transhumanism?
Well, I'm interested in how it impacts transhumanist concerns, I guess. But I guess I'm thinking about the large scale, really, that these kinds of transhumanist concerns are really coming to fundamentalist communities at an increasing pace. So I'm curious, both from the inside and from the outside, how people might look at those, or what might be a healthier way to frame that.
Well, I did. before I started working on human enhancement, I did for a number of years work on fundamentalism and wrote a book called Slaves to Faith, A Therapist Looks Inside the Fundamentalist Mind. And basically what I did was I drew upon my clinical background in psychology, particularly cognitive psychology, to try to understand fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is, and I speak not only as a, you know, as a scholar looking outside, but I grew up fundamentalist. I mean, I understand from the inside, I think, fundamentalist thinking. And I think fundamentalism, and I think this is generally agreed upon by scholars of fundamentalism, that fundamentalism is, to a large degree, a reaction to modernity. It is really a modern movement in the sense that, you know, we live in a world that is so changing so fast. The communication technology, transportation, and so on. And I think it overwhelms people. And fundamentalism is understood one way it's understood is as a reaction against modernity, about the tremendous fast changes that are occurring that overwhelm us. It's not the same thing, but politically, nationalism, I think, is to some degree a, you know, retrenchment. It's also a reaction. I mean, we see this in the political processes in America and Britain to some degree. So that's kind of the big picture. And so underneath, and this is a heavy assessment on my part, I understand that, but I think, I don't want to generalize by saying every fundamentalist fits this category, but I think to a significant degree, for many fundamentalists, I think there is some anxiety about the world, and understandable. I mean, I'm not fundamentalist anymore, but I have anxiety about the world.
Yeah.
And it is a scary world. And so fundamentalism is a framework, a religious framework, that offers a comfort and safety in the face of the tremendous existential threats that abound. And so that's kind of one way to understand it. It is a defense against anxiety. And the threat of non-being. And so transhumanism and all of the remarkable, incredible developments that we see abounding in all of these different fields that we're talking about just jack up the whole odds here or the stakes here in terms of what's at stake. I mean, for Pete's sake, you and I have talked earlier in this conversation about the potential termination of the human species.
Right. We casually just mentioned that in passing.
Yeah. And so, you know, what does that do? Because it's no longer just, you know, fringe science fiction movies saying this. I mean, there are very serious people. I'm talking about MIT and Oxford and you know, very serious people who are working on the superintelligence and the concern that is going to... you know, really, you know, that superintelligence is not going to have the value system to protect human beings.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of anxiety out there. And I think fundamentalism, now, how do you, you know, I mean, my view, Christian fundamentalism is oriented around the Bible and a particular understanding of the Bible. So I don't think that, that you necessarily have to disregard that. I mean, the Bible is a critical, important part of the Christian tradition, whatever theological stripe you are. And because of my background in biblical studies, that's really what my PhD is in, is biblical studies, then I bring to concerns about radical life extension and mind uploading and superintelligence, I bring a theological assessment, but it is a theological assessment that is greatly informed by biblical studies and by biblical themes. Now, I might not utilize those themes in ways that an ardent fundamentalist might, but we're certainly talking about the same text. And I think I know how to frame these things. I mean, I am affirming in my work on mind uploading, whole brain emulation, I am affirming resurrection. I'm saying, yes, Paul had a notion that, you know, I adhere to and I can affirm. And let's see how this relates, you know, to this particular technological development. So the language you use has a lot to do with whether conversation is going to occur between different, you know, religious parties.
Yeah. I would say just my own kind of personal vantage point. I've felt the same way about many fundamentalists, is that, you know, there's a incredible importance placed on the Bible, and yet it's not that they are even particularly well versed in the Bible or skilled at understanding what the Bible is saying. It's that, you know, this is the touch point. And so when someone's willing to enter those conversations and say, okay, well, let's look at what it's really saying or what it's really getting at, then that becomes the basis for a real conversation rather than the basis for just simple non-communication.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. That's it's a great perspective on so many different aspects of this conversation. Before we go, do you have any resources that you think people should look into, or any places where they should kind of follow your ongoing work?
Well, they can probably just Google my name and see the various publications, many of which are you know, meant for scholars or scholarly. But my co-editors and I, you know, try to write in ways and encourage our colleagues to write in ways that are accessible by, you know, an informed layperson. So people in your audience should, you know, should be able to understand, you know, these things. I'm also starting to engage in a project that's not scholarly, that is designed to support churches as they work on these issues. So I'm going to be working on that in the next few months. And because I have been encouraging that every religion needs to be having, and temples and synagogues and mosques and churches need to be having study groups where they're exploring these questions. I mean, they need to be about it, because if not, then the decisions about funding and about the direction of research and about what might unfold is going to be left into the hands of who? Well, maybe, you know, the billionaire class. Well, you know, they're not bad, but is that, or do you want them to make all these decisions to be made as business decisions?
Right.
You want to leave it in the hands of politicians? You want to leave it in the hands of terrorists? So I think people of faith need to get informed about these issues, and I'm going to be, on the Christian side, I'm going to be working on something that can be a tool for that. I would also mention that I've lectured at Alcor, which is a cryonics, right, the leading cryonics. I lectured I gave a presentation at their national meeting, and I've lectured at Baptist settings and all in between. And I think that what we all have to do is we have to really work at, you know, having conversations. That's a big part of what I'm doing. Is, I mean, I am staking out positions and arguing for certain things, but a big part of what I want to do is just to get the conversation going, get the scholars and lay people working on this. And so on the lay side, I'm pretty active, you know, giving lectures and leading programs and things like that in the faith communities. And what I find is that it's very possible to do this. It takes sensitivity. It takes, you know, commitment to have a genuine conversation and to disagree, but these kind of conversations can happen. And, they're easier to happen with, the younger the audience, the quicker they clue into the technologies. You know, someone who's 40 and above, it takes a few minutes to explain the technology, and then you can have the theological conversation. But it's interesting, it's important, and you know, I'm very. I think you could give my email, mercerc@ecu.edu. People could find me at East Carolina University, but I'm, you know, open for that kind of conversation too, as my schedule permits.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, I'll definitely be looking forward to your new project and you know, continuing to kind of explore your work with Steve Fuller and some of these other thinkers. I'll put links to some of that in the show notes, and so people can find some of those things. And yeah, we'll keep up with what you're doing, and look forward to seeing more of it. So thanks so much, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you so much, Micah. Give yourself a good day.
All right, you too.